That's a great question.
Here I am as Miss Kentucky, competed in Miss America, and it's been really an amazing journey.
So in Lexington in particular, we mostly resettle Congolese, and we have the largest population of Congolese within Kentucky.
And he said to me, science is cool, learning is fun. That's what we do.
All the schools in Kentucky presenting a Power Word presentation, which talks about verbal bullying, negative perceptions in hip-hop, how to challenge our peers when they use negative words. At the end of the day, words do matter, and it's a catalyst for action.
That's a great question. That's a powerful question. That's a question that I hope that all of us will continue to ponder on.
We'll be getting back out to playing live, but some places that I do like playing here in Lexington.
I tend to focus on local issues, local people, you know, local being Kentucky.
So we've got these various battles raging between the Attorney General and the governor, and in the background is the former governor.
This is a myth that is really common.
Mountain Dew is not a contraceptive.
Probably is going to cause a pretty bad yeast infection.
An extreme yeast infection.
If you can't deep fry it, spray paint in gold.
Now, will the animal send you like a postcard as a thank you with a little paw print on it?
Who's at fault more, men or women?
The vetting process. Did you already ask that? Okay.
It works.
If it's Friday and you too lost your voice screaming for an encore at last night's Talib Kweli show, then you're listening to Bluegrass Bios on WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio. Just a quick intro here before we bring in our first guest, Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation founder and president, Mr. Chris Kimmel. My name is Kyle Bigelow. I'm joined, as always, by Benjaneer Wolf.
Hey, Kyle.
And we were expecting our favorite and only guest co-host, maybe slipping out of favorite at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He's lost in traffic, so we're...
Happens to the best of us.
Indeed, and the worst. So I guess to keep the ball bouncing in the air for a second, Ben, and Alex now connotes to me zoo tragedies because of his story last week.
Yes.
There's been in the news that the NFL is reinstating the ability for fans to customize jerseys with the name Harambe on the back of it. Now, for those of you
who may not know,
I guess that would be the blind, deaf, and dumb.
Yes.
Harambe is the gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo who was shot and killed when a small child wandered into and fell into the gorilla pit because Harambe doesn't have proper babysitting training. He got a little rough with the boy, and and they had to shoot him with actual bullet because the tranquilizer dart would never have worked properly in time. So this begs the question, and the NFL has said that it was a mistake how
that they allowed this to come back online?
That they allowed it to be taken off in the first place.
Oh, okay.
And this is, you know, this is facing outrage from a community of people who remain outraged about the death of Harambe.
Yes.
Now, I know that gorilla got he took an unfair one, right? He took a
bad
L. He didn't deserve that, right? But who are these people who are still angry with their profile pictures of Harambe?
Yeah.
Who are these people?
Yeah, I want to be on their side. I really do.
You think their heart's in the right place?
Absolutely, their heart's in the right place. And they care about animals. They care about all of God's creatures.
I feel like your heart can be in a right-er place.
A right-er place? I think you could prioritize.
Now, I don't want to go as far as, say, you know, what is still the truth that in that time, half a dozen people have been shot and killed, black people is what I mean, shot and killed in confrontations with the police that have been caught on tape.
And lots of people have died unnecessarily in lots of different venues and methods, and not just the police. And just,
sure,
it does seem like they value the life of.
But while we're all screaming at each other back and forth about Black Lives Matter, which seems to be a no-brainer to me,
me too. Well, Alex. Yep.
We're still arguing about Harambe.
I think maybe
Dr. Alex joins us in studio now.
Maybe it's just such an easy issue that it's obviously wrong, and people can you know, show their support for it without, you know, any kind of controversy, without inundated on Twitter.
To the
or
point
Facebook.
Where you're sending angry letters to the NFL players' shop that you should be able to buy a jersey with that name on the back. Like, I understand that we can all kind of get behind this, and that's what I wanted to kind of lay out. Like, look, I think we can all understand, like, that this is a tragedy, that unfortunately, like, sorry, like, it had to go down that way. There really was no other choice, except maybe don't have a crappy zoo in Cincinnati. Maybe do that.
A little better security.
So Dr. Alex joins us now. I was talking about this. I don't know if you're familiar with the Harambe new development.
No, what is the new development?
All right, so to recap, NFL has names that are restricted for putting on their customized jerseys.
Okay.
And Harambe was on that list. That met a lot of outrage. The NFL came back and said that was an accident. They don't know how that happened. Now, I don't know how bad you have to be as a typist to accidentally write in Harambe, or what sort of oversight would happen there. Like, when I think of...
Well, this is interesting. If you go to, like, the MLB store, the Major League Baseball store, and you try to get a Cincinnati Reds jersey with number 14 and Rose on it, they will not make it for you.
Sure.
Right. So they have these kind of valves in the system for stuff like this.
Well,
but can you just...
That one makes more sense.
I mean, but it's still, it seems to me like it's still easy to circumvent, because you can get a customized jersey just not through the NFL store.
Sure, right? But it would be a knockoff.
No, but wouldn't it still be a whatever the official licensed product is, but it's just some stores customizing it instead of the NFL customizing it?
No, because you can only buy the official. I mean, you could buy a blank jersey, probably.
That's what I'm saying. Buy a blank jersey and then go to somebody throw a name on it. Like, when I was a kid, right? Probably. I was a big Don Mattingly fan. You know, I remember getting a number 23 Yankees jersey and then putting Estrada on the back of it. And I paid like $20, and I thought that was like the funniest thing in the world. In hindsight, I was probably the biggest poser in the world. But still, I mean, you could do that. And it was an official Yankees jersey.
Yeah, I wonder if it's legal or not to be able to do that. I mean, if you're a good enough seamstress, you could do it yourself, right?
Yeah,
but
sure.
I don't know.
People do it on the cheap.
Exactly. This is like... The only reason that I really wanted to bring it up is because I knew that you were coming in, and you connote to me zoo-related tragedies at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if that monkey that I witnessed get killed had a name. I wonder if he had a family, kids. It keeps me up at night.
You could get a jersey.
# Joseph the monkey. All right. That was a wonderful first segment, I think.
Well, it's like, why did they take it down to begin with? I mean, who cares? You know, somebody wants to get a jersey.
Who cares is exactly my point.
So why did they go through the effort to take it down?
Somebody must have found it in poor taste or whatever, but I mean, please. I mean, these days anybody finds anything in poor taste and creates an uproar.
Yes. All right, so what we're going to do now is go to music for a couple of minutes. I'm going to brief Dr. Alex on our upcoming guest. His name is Chris Kimmel. He's the president and founder of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation and a host of other space and technology and innovation-related companies. He's going to be an interesting guy. So, Ben.
And at 1:15, we got Bryant Carter.
The return of Bryant Carter.
Really enjoyed talking
to him. The Bryant C Project. He may or may not be in here with an acoustic guitar.
Hopefully.
So stay tuned with that as well. We'll be right back. This is Bluegrass Bios on Lexington Community. Welcome back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios on Lexington Community Radio. Our next guest is an accomplished University of Kentucky grad, entrepreneur, and founder of Idea Festival. He's also the president of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation and Kentucky Space. Those are two separate endeavors. The Elon Musk of the bluegrass, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Kimmel. Thank you for joining us, Chris.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Chris, you started the company that would become the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation in 1987 to, and I'm quoting directly from your website here, create an innovation-driven entrepreneurial economy that makes Kentucky a leader in the development of knowledge and its application to people, firms, and organizations. Innovation in my life is basically just trying to get the podcast uploaded faster. What does innovation mean to you in the context of KSTC?
Well, basically, we were, I mean, that was a mouthful. We were basically created and really from the beginning have been focused on creating and pushing innovation, disruptive thinking from the standpoint of either developing, improving on a product or an idea, or in many cases, starting something, brand new. Over the past, really, I'd say decade or two, we've also become focused really on something we call, one of our mantras is, you got to be willing to embrace the danger of big ideas. And so we've really started to focus on the idea that part of what you're doing, whether you're a radio station or whether you're a state or a company, university, whatever, is part of your portfolio has to have some extreme ideas in there. You need to be looking for things because most of them aren't going to be successful. But to really push the envelope, you've got to get away from just being marginally better and strive for things that, if they work, and there's a high risk, high return ratio there, but if they work, are going to make a big difference in people's lives.
What were the early years like for such an ambitious company?
They were tough. It was just me part-time for the first 3 years. I actually started it, co-founded Idea KSTC with Lee Todd, Dr. Todd, before he was president of UK. He was a budding entrepreneur at that time, and he and I had gotten to know each other. So it was just me part-time for the first 2.5-3 years, and we were pretty much running on fumes and trying to figure out what we were going to do. So it was while it started as a nonprofit, it basically was like any kind of startup. We were just I did everything. I took out the trash. I wrote the articles, whatever had to be done. And then after about 3 or 4 years, we started to get some traction on some issues and began to grow. Since then, and now we're up to about 32 employees at KSTC.
Do you remember your first major success?
Yes, I do, actually. It was interesting. I'm real big on serendipity, too, in terms of part of innovation. We had decided to, we were basically almost running out of money, and we decided to write up something we called the Kentucky Innovation Compact, which was a very brief strategy, kind of 10 key things that we thought Kentucky should do in order to really break out of its mold. And we published that, nothing much happened after we put it out there at a press conference, and people said, yeah, it looks pretty good. And I was actually in Hawaii on vacation with my wife, and I got a call. At that time, there were no cell phones, so I literally had an answering service. So I got a call, sent a message, and it was from the James Graham Brown Foundation, and they said, we've seen this compact, and there's a couple of these programs in here that we're really interested in, and we'd like to know if you could put together a proposal really quick for us for $250,000.
No brainer.
Yeah. So I got back and I sat down and I wrote a proposal and we were successful, and that was really the turning point because we were about out of money by that time, and that kind of got us on a very different trajectory. That particular program was focused a lot on activity centered science for elementary students, et cetera, and that kind of got us kind of got us through that difficult time and got us on a path that I think where we've kind of are still on that pathway today.
So the initial stages were sort of centered around STEM education?
STEM education, entrepreneurship. Anytime you're starting a new company, your first product becomes whatever someone wants to buy. And sometimes it's not exactly what you think you're going to be selling. And so I think we kind of started out with looking at, entrepreneurship, starting innovation-driven companies, STEM education, and others. And that one was the one that we kind of first hit on. And then we really focused on that for several years. We still do a lot in STEM, but we do a lot more than that now. We are very heavily involved in helping to start and grow and fund new entrepreneurial companies. And we've now started, we'll get into that, we've now spun off 3 subsidiary companies under the broad umbrella of KSDC, including two nonprofit and 1 for-profit.
I'm curious as to how you marketed at first, getting off the ground and getting your name out there, and how that's evolved to now. Because I mean, I've seen some of your literature; it's very professionally produced stuff, and obviously you all doing well. So how did that evolve?
It was interesting because this was before social media,
before the internet
and all this kind of stuff. And so it was pretty much me in a car driving around and making phone calls and writing guest editorials for the newspapers and the Courier and the Herald and other things like that. And it was very much hand-to-hand combat. And because there was a lot of the things we take for granted today simply weren't available. And so you had to be really persistent and creative in how you reach people, and it also moved as a result of that. It moved very, very slow.
Chris Kimmel, he's the founder and president of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation. Can you tell us a little about some of the research and development your company has funded?
Yeah, we have a couple of programs. One is the Kentucky Science and Engineering Foundation, another is called the EPSCoR program. And we support, we have some state money. We're not part of the state, we're a completely independent company, but we have some contracts with the state. And one of the things we launched in the state funds are some research programs where faculty from the various universities submit proposals to us to be reviewed. We peer review them. With all external reviewers, means outside of Kentucky, and fund what we think are promising proposals in a variety of areas, everything from clean energy to biotech to biomedical, internet communications, IT, you name it. We really don't focus on any particular area. We're just looking for really interesting, well-written proposals and ideas. And so we have funded a lot of those over the past 15, 20 years.
What stands out in your mind as something you've been on the vanguard of?
Well, I think that our team is we've been on the vanguard, I think, of a lot of things. We have a program called Advanced Kentucky, which is focusing on demonstrably and rapidly accelerating participation in advanced classes, advanced placement classes in math, science, and also, ironically, in English. For high school students. And now we've just gotten into computer science. That's headed up by Joanne Lang. And their statistics are just amazing. I mean, it's one of the top programs in the country. And they've just touched a ton of students. Also, the program run by Rick Krasinski, which is called the EPSCoR program, which is an acronym, experimental program to stimulate competitive research, started by NSF. They funded a lot of interesting projects at universities. That program was created for states that are not in the top tier of the research states as a way of spreading the money around a little bit. And then Mahendra Jain, who runs our Kentucky Science and Engineering Foundation, we work closely with the Council on Postsecondary Education and the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development, and he runs that program, which focuses a lot on research that's more down the commercial path, kind of beyond just a discovery, and also works on the SBIR, STTR match program. Those are SBIR and STTR, 2 programs run by the federal government, where each federal agency puts a very small percentage of their money into a pool to fund companies. And so it's actually to spur technology-driven companies. And then we also, Rick Johnson, our office, who heads up works on the Kentucky Innovation Network, which we work on with the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development, is a statewide network all across the state to help build technology and innovation-driven companies. So it's pretty. We're pretty diversified.
Are you the tip of the spear when it comes to that for Kentucky?
I mean, I think we're clearly one. I wouldn't say that we're necessarily the tip of the spear, but I think you know we would like to think we're one of the leaders. We work very closely again with the state and with the private sector and companies, et cetera. Good relationships, a lot of federal agencies, but we are independent, and I think being independent has allowed us to move very quickly, historically, and take a lot of risk. And I think that's, we've had a lot of success. We've had a lot of failures. And the failures have outweighed the successes, and that's okay. That's the way it should be. If you don't have more failures than success, you're not taking enough risk.
That's it.
I concur. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
It's a good life lesson as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You coined the Chris Kimmel, the president of Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation, with us. You coined a term I learned today, exomedicine.
Right.
Can you explain to our audience what exomedicine is?
I will, and then I'll give you a big background. We define exomedicine as the research, development, and commercial application and solutions of biomedical solutions in space, microgravity in space for applications on Earth. And a little bit of history is most of the work that has been done historically in microgravity in space has been focused on astronaut health. And it also has been somewhat episodic. I mean, there's been a lot done, certainly the early days of the Mercury program and before and all the way up to Shuttle and now in the new era we're in now with the SpaceX's of the world. And NASA's done an enormous amount of really top research on that. There's a lot to learn from that. But it's been very kind of episodic and also it was never really specifically focused on applications on Earth. I mean, there was some research that was done in that area, some work, so I don't want to imply that we invented that. We didn't. Really what we did was we just became interested in understanding microgravity as a new medium, a new physics medium to solve problems on Earth. And so we coined that phrase to really package that idea, to differentiate it distinctly from the more general space biology that goes on, which involves both looking at things in space for astronauts and also applications on Earth, but even biology in the sense of even with astrobiology and things like that, where it looks at potentially living life on other planets, etc. That we really wanted to make focus specifically and very strategically on solving problems on Earth. As we've said, one of our first people that work for us, Twyman Clemens, made a comment once, said, we're not as focused on the six people up there meeting on the station as the 7 billion down here. And that, there's a little bit longer story if you want me to go into it, just a little bit loud, we got into that.
Sure.
But back around 10 years ago, we'd always done a few things at KSDC with NASA, nothing big. But about 10 years ago, we began to observe what we thought was a real turning point in the space industry and the opening up of entrepreneurial space. And that was being driven by new access to space, which we could see coming. NASA was becoming much more innovative and opening up launches off Shuttle. And they were making plans to open it up even more down the road like it has now. And secondly, the incredibly rapid advance of microtechnologies was beginning to allow us and others to build very small, modest cost, but high value technology platforms that weren't possible. And I got introduced, we actually had a small office at the time out at NASA Ames Research Center, and I was out there one time, and I got introduced to Bob Twiggs. And Bob Twiggs, at that time, was the head of the Space Science Lab at Stanford University. And he was the co-inventor of something called the CubeSat-class satellite. The CubeSat-class satellite was a satellite, an incredibly small satellite, about the size of one of those little Kleenex tissue boxes, the small ones. Yeah. And it was a miniature satellite. Again, it was made possible by miniature technologies and all these new things that were on the horizon. And of course, when Bob first developed it, people laughed at it. They thought it was a joke. They said, oh, it's a toy, and no one will ever want to use that. Maybe high school students. Well, here we are, 10, 12 years later, and it's a huge industry. I mean, we have companies out in Silicon Valley raising tens of millions of dollars completely based around CubeSat technologies and launching, in many cases, swarms of these small satellites. So that's how we originally got interested. We got very interested in that technology, and we said, we think this is something we can do in Kentucky. It was very new. We thought, we've got really bright, creative people. We can do this. And so we basically did We actually created it, that we created Kentucky Space, which was the first space company we created. It was a subsidiary nonprofit. We did a contract with Stanford University, and we actually identified a number of students and faculty, and we paid for them off money we raised to go out and spend the entire summer at NASA Ames.
Well, we're an amazing opportunity. I mean, for those kids as well as for the local adults.
And basically they spent 3 months out there learning how to build small satellites. And so they came back, and we started on this quest of building, you know, our first foray was building these small satellites. We started with, you know, our first, and then the next year we sent some more students, but we started with high-altitude balloons. That's what we first started launching with payloads. And we moved to suborbital launches. Several suborbital launches where we put small spacecraft satellites into suborbit, meaning they weren't in orbit, but they were up 15 minutes in space, and then we graduated to orbital launches. And in the meantime, in the process, our first two big launches that we had that we were all excited about both failed. It wasn't us. It was the launch vehicles. You know,
you're succeeding.
Yeah,
it was like that rocket that blew up last week or something.
SpaceX. It was our very first suborbital launch, which was out of White Sands, New Mexico. I was there for it. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. It was cold, desert. We were so excited. We were going to go to space for the first time, and we lost the launch vehicle about 1.7 seconds after it launched, and we had about 15 students out there. So you can imagine we were pretty devastated. And then we kind of came back and, you know, dusted ourselves off and said, okay. And we, you know, really, it sounds ridiculous, but it's kind of like the Sopranos. You know, you have to look at each other and go, "This is the life we've chosen."
Yeah, there you go. I like that.
Because when you're in the space business, you're going to lose launch vehicles.
Being a New Yorker, I like that.
I mean, it's I like that. And we came back, and then we, you know, went back, and it set us back about a year. But we built another. Of course, we weren't building the launch vehicle. We were only building the satellites. Came back, and we had a very successful suborbital launch a year and a half later out of White Sands.
Do you still have satellites orbiting?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a couple still up there. I don't know that they're not working. Their functionality is over. They were designed to last eight months to a year, but of course in the orbital mechanics they're in, they won't decay out of orbit for probably another 10 years. So they're still up there. And then we graduated and said, okay, this time we're going to put one in orbit. That went up on an orbital vehicle out of California, Vanderbilt. That one we lost. It basically after launch, it did not deploy the cover of this of the capsule, and so it was not able to reach enough speed to reach orbit. So we lost that, and then we subsequently to that have launched and successfully.
And you learned from your mistakes.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. So this thing deployed. I'm sure you redesigned it or whatever.
Well, it wasn't like I said. That was something on the rocket, not our. We were like a $300,000.
Okay.
Vehicle.
So the rocket.
It was like on the SpaceX. You know, the satellite on top of that. It was actually the rocket that failed.
Right.
But then we then came back, and subsequent to that, we've launched, particularly with Morehead State University. We work with UK as well, but Morehead State University's got a great space science center. We've launched by ourselves and with them a number of orbital vehicles. And then as we were developing and launching these orbital vehicles, we were approached by a company that we started to get this reputation within this small space industry, this kind of crazy group in Kentucky of all places that was, you know, getting a reputation for doing really wild things quickly and really well. And they approached us.
Hold my beer.
Us.
Watch this.
Yeah, exactly. And they approached us and said, "Hey, we need somebody to build some technology for us for space station, you know, really quickly. And would you be willing to do it?" We said, "Sure." One of my philosophies of innovation is you never say no to anything.
Right.
There's always time to get out. There's always time 6 months down. So, you know, we really thought we could do this, but once you say no at the beginning, all your options are over. And so we always say yes. I don't care if they said you want to build this, you know, if you want to, build a craft to go to Mars, we'd have gone, "Yeah, oh, yeah, sure, cool."
What could some of the practical applications of having a CubeSat satellite
Well, a satellite itself, I mean, a lot of remote sensing and data because they can move in swarms, and they can get a much better resolution on a much smaller place. Plus, you can cover the entire globe if you've got a number of those going out there. If you lose one or two, it's not a big deal. relatively speaking, because they're not that expensive. And while you're getting an orbit every 90-plus minutes on a typical satellite, with those, you may have, you know, again, inexpensive multiples. And then you also gives you an ability to really innovate, because you can, you know, you can put up 50 in 1 year and come back 18 months later and put up another 50. You can control the life cycle of those, because what orbit you put them in, you know, tells you how long they're going to be up there. So there's lots of applications. In fact, Morehead State University, right now, Ben Malfers, who heads that up, and we work very closely with, they've just gotten NASA money. They're actually building what they call a 2U CubeSat. Each CubeSat is 1 kilogram, so this 2U would be about the size of 2 or 3 tissue boxes. They're actually building one now to go to the moon.
I'm curious as to with the Swarm satellites, the CubeSat, or just your satellites in general, the logistics with getting them into orbit. And, you know, I've heard a lot about, you know, space garbage.
Yep.
And, you know, that's other larger vehicles going up there. What's in the way? What's not in the way? How do you keep yours out of the way?
Interestingly enough, you have to get NORAD. It has to be big enough for NORAD to track it. We've actually developed some with Morehead, some really, really small satellites that are questionable, and they haven't let us launch them yet. We did launch some out of Russia, but they haven't let us launch any yet. But we think they are going to be.
I have friends in Russia,
problem.
By the way.
Okay, we launched a satellite out of Russia. A lot of Russian launch vehicles. And it's really interesting because that we launched one satellite out of Wallops Island, NASA launch facility, into orbit, and then less than 48 hours later, we had another team in Baikonur in Russia launching another satellite. Both of those satellites were launched on old ICBMs.
Wow.
So they were basically both launched on vehicles. At one point
hey,
in time,
NORAD, something's going up. Just stand down. We're good. It's just us Kentuckians tooling with our satellites.
We're pointed at each other during the Cold War.
Wow.
So that was kind of an interesting. And then we launched it out of Russia 2 days later, a different satellite.
Okay. So, but what is the concern with having all this?
Okay. Well,
space
that's
debris?
That's a big issue. The whole space debris issue is really surfacing as a major issue. You have to be able to track it. You have to get clearance from them to launch. I mean, no, you can't just launch something into space. You have to, you know, get clearance to launch it. You have to tell where you're going to launch it. What's the orbital mechanics? Where is it going to be? How long is it going to be up there? They've now set some standards on that where particularly on the type of satellite it can only be in orbit so long. So you have to put it in an orbit trajectory that is only, you know, where it's going to decay. They're also talking a lot now about having systems on these orbits that deorbit them, so that once their life is over, once they've done what they're supposed to do, that kicks in and actually deorbits them and they burn up in the atmosphere. So there's lots of questions and issues out there about how to deal with not, you know, the debris that's already up there, but also the accumulation of additional debris as you know, the world becomes much more of a spacefaring civilization, which we are. I mean, there's tons more satellites going up now than ever in the history, and a lot of these are very, very small satellites. And then you're talking now about, you know, you've got space station up there. The Chinese, I see, just launched their second space station. And so as we become a much more space-faring civilization, those issues are going to, you know, they're going to have to be resolved somehow, and they're starting now. But you have to, it's very, you know, it's not everybody can launch. NORAD and NASA, you know, restrict what you can do, what you can't do.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I just did a, you know, cursory superficial search on, you know, space debris, and there's, like, debris, trackable debris of all, you know, sizes and shapes and whatnot, but debris of about 10 centimeters in size, 29,000. I'm sorry, larger than 10 centimeters, there are 29,000 items floating around out there.
Show you how amazing it is. So if we get some of the small satellites that we've launched are still in orbit, and when they, if they come close to another satellite, we will get a notice from NORAD. I mean, we'll get a notice that says, just a notice saying, you're, just want to let you know you came within, you know, so many, you know, miles of a satellite or something like that. So it's a, you know, they're pretty serious about that stuff. So, but quickly back. So as we went back in, as we decided that we would build that piece of technology, we built that technology, and as we were building that technology for the station, and I might add, that was put up on station, I think 2011, 2012. It was completely
This is the International Space Station.
Yeah, completely built here in Lexington, and it's currently still up there. It's currently still operating for this company. that got us interested in space station, and we began to see some different kinds of opportunities in microgravity. And we started, while we still do some satellite work, Moorhead does most of their work is on satellites, so they do some exomedicine work with us now and starting to do more. We really got more on the pathway of the International Space Station, and that's what got us into exomedicine, because as we were developing this platform for this other company, we had to develop it in a way that would be able to run a variety of different experiments, physical sciences, et cetera, including health and biomedical. And when we got into that, we began to understand that we actually didn't know very much about how biological processes operate outside of gravity.
So can you give us an example of a microgravity concept that you've been able to implement or apply here on Earth?
Well, there's been some. It's a new frontier. It really is, and there's not a lot that's been done. I mean, we've been in this heavily for 2, 3, 4 years now. There's something that came out of NASA, I think, that dealt with a salmonella drug that emanated from some kind of different configuration they saw in space. We see three potential applications in exomedicine that we've always thought about and continue. One, when you go to space, all physical and biological processes are scrambled. There are four forces in nature: weak force, strong force, gravity, and electromagnetism. So when you're taking one of those forces away, you're changing the environment in which things operate in dramatically. And so our assumption is our assumption, along with a lot of other people, is that by going to microgravity, that environment, you're basically setting up an environment to scramble things. So one, by going into that microgravity environment, and I'll give you some examples, you will, you may see things that you would never see on Earth. It would give you a different insight into how different systems, organisms, etc., operate. Different forms of gene expression, because you would never see those on Earth. So it opens a door for you to say, wow, we never knew this would do this. And I'll give you an example of something we did with Tufts University. We're doing with them that it's a good example. So one, that gives you a new way of coming back and saying, it gives us a new insight onto how we might think about dealing with this. Secondly, we absolutely believe, and we're already in the early stage involved in this, that we will be bioengineering and biomanufacturing things in space, because the reconfiguration, the restructuring of those things are so great,
like that you end, or what?
It's not impossible. There's a lot of interest. We're doing some really interesting work now in regenerative medicine with Tufts University. Kidneys, cells, we're doing some interesting drug design work. We're actually flying a series of plants on SpaceX 10, which was supposed to be in November. It's probably going to push now because of the mishap on the launch pad. But on SpaceX 10, and it's actually what we're doing, is we're going to be germinating those plants in space. These are really simple plants. They're actually, you can plant them in your backyard and little flowers. But they're about, they're called the Madagascar periwinkle. But they're actually, the compounds in these plants are responsible for about 80% of chemo drugs. So we're taking those up and going to germinate them in space, put them up there for 6 weeks, bring them back. We're working with Dr. Joe Chappelle at UK, to look at how that structure might change in a microgravity environment.
So with the concept that you'll get a greater yield and be able to
decrease the cost. The great thing about it is it's pure discovery. We don't know what's going to happen. And in most cases, we don't know. We are also in the middle of a regenerative medicine project with Tufts University, Dr. Michael Levin's lab, and he focuses a lot on these what are called planarian flatworms as the focus of his work, because they're basically indestructible. They're about half inch long, inch and a half long. If you cut them in threes, the tails will grow heads, the heads will grow tails, and the midsection will orient itself and grow a head and a tail. So he wanted to understand.
Wow. So that's some pretty sci-fi.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can imagine
if you could extract whatever.
Yeah. So everybody wants to know why. Can we do that too?
Yeah. I'm thinking here from a surgical standpoint. I'm a surgeon. Every week, I'm cutting toes off, cutting feet off.
Exactly.
Amputations. If we could extract this and grow somebody's
whatever mechanism
toe back,
is,
whatever,
yeah.
it's amazing.
So he's interested in understanding what goes on in microgravity. So we put him up there for 6 weeks. We brought him back. He saw a number of changes. We also have an office. We have an office at the Life Sciences Lab at Kennedy Space Center as well, because we do all of our late load stuff down there. We do all of our last minute biological
road trip
prepping.
Disney World.
So we can go. We could go on the rocket 24 hours for launch. It came back. They saw a lot of interesting change. One of the things that they saw that was really, really fascinating to them, and we're working on the second iteration of the mission now, is one of the midsections came back and had grown two heads. Mm. And even more interesting than that, its offspring had two heads. Whoa. So,
it's almost like a change in the genetics.
Epigenetics. We also debated whether we've actually created the first aliens.
Right. Well, it's a change in the genetic expression. Yes.
Yeah.
And what it does is when the cells are dividing embryonically, it's growing two neural tubes, and that's how it's growing the second head.
Yeah, so you almost never see that in nature unless it's chemically induced. So you know we're working on the sex. Next piece of that. We now have active projects and missions in drug design, regenerative medicine, glioblastoma. We've flown some glioblastoma work in the past. We're doing some really interesting work now with cystic fibrosis. We actually have a young doctor we work with in Ireland who just got a full Fulbright scholarship to come to the U.S. to work with us on cystic fibrosis in space. She's got some really interesting hypothesis. And diabetes, stem cells. But these are all, like I said, I'm not going to say nobody's ever done anything, but I for example...
It's still emerging, though, isn't it?
When I spent 2 years, when we first started to think about this, we really thought we were wrong. We thought, you know, what do we know? We're here in Lexington, Kentucky. You know, we go to the Cats games. I mean, we don't know anything. So we went out and spent 2 years validating it. Is this assumption correct? And we ended up meeting with a lot of people, including Nobel Prize winners in medicine. I had a long couple conversations with Dr. Barry Bloomberg, who was a Nobel Prize winner in medicine for discovering the hepatitis B virus and vaccine. He actually was on our scientific advisory board. He co-authored a synthesis paper on exomedicine with us. And I spent a day at the Dana-Farber Cancer Center with Edward Benz, who's the president, and his five top people. So here's one of the top cancer centers in the world. They had never thought about cancer in the absence of gravity. Said never really occurred to them. And so one of our big challenges, what we've been working on, is the first thing we have to do is getting people thinking about this. And you can understand it because they never really thought they could get there. And up to this point, it was incredibly expensive. And there was some experimentation going, but not a lot. And so it's really a new frontier. And so I was just at NIH 2 weeks ago briefing them. There's just a lot of activity going on trying to get people. What we really need are really bright doctors. Who will think about this, because that's the first step is people have to start imagining, you know.
The possibility.
What's the possibility here? What would I want to understand? What would I want to look at? What might change if you, in fact, took gravity completely out of the equation?
You certainly got my attention.
Yeah, so that's where we are.
And speaking of that, there was one thing on your website that kind of jumped out at me. Was the Governor's School for Entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
That was developed by KSDC and actually by Laurie Daugherty, who's the director of that. A couple of years ago, we wanted to create a program like Governor Scholars, but was for students. We just ran the third program. It's very successful. We just spun it off as an independent entity now. So Laurie is now running that entity, and they're doing it with the Workforce Development Cabinet. So we've done that before. Sometimes we start things, get them going, and then we spin them off as their own entity. And so that's actually a separate now nonprofit that is doing the Governor's School for Entrepreneurs. But Laurie Daugherty, she's actually in Lexington, and they've will be working on their fourth program this next year.
And is that for high school students?
Yes, it's for high school students. Yeah.
Chris Kimmel, founder and president of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation. Well, as long as we've gone from the extraterrestrial to the terrestrial, I want to sort of shift gears here onto the Idea Festival. If you could maybe start by explaining what the Idea Festival is and what was your impetus for creating it.
Our impetus was really much like what we've been talking about. I mean, we have a really strong belief in the importance of innovation and creativity and imagination, and really feel that that is at the heart of change and progress. And it's also, we also have a strong sense that, first of all, there's no such thing as useless knowledge. Innovation is innovation, whether it happens in medicine, the arts, design, business, it's still innovation, and everybody can learn from that. And I think we make mistakes sometimes by compartmentalizing our side and saying, oh, what will I learn from an artist? You know, I'm a doctor. Or if I'm an artist, what would I learn from a doctor? I'm an artist. When in fact, you can learn a lot because their creativity, their imagination, how they approach problems, how they think about things, while somewhat different, has a direct connection to what you're doing. So it's really about connecting the dots. So we wanted to create something that brought together people from ideas and people from all different disciplines over 2 to 3 days, this huge mashup where you were just bombarded with all of these different ideas and people from all these different disciplines. And we're, you know, there is no track. You know, people all the time will come to me and go, well, it looks interesting. I'm busy. Do you have a business day? Well, we don't have a business day. You know, we don't do it. We design it, so it's very chaotic in that sense. But it really is about helping people connect the dots and exposing people to lots of big, challenging ideas that are outside their fields. But with not only just to, you know, make them aware of it, but to challenge them to figure out how is this relevant to me? How can I take this thing out of this venue that this person's doing, and you know, it can make it useful to what I'm doing. So that's really what it's about. It's more of like a film festival than a conference. It's kind of, you know, eclectic. There's half hour breaks between each session, receptions every night, and so there's a lot of room for networking and people. A lot of very diverse, you know, a lot of diversity. A lot of students attend, adults, people. You know, companies like FedEx fly 10, 12 of their managers in every year from Memphis as a professional development opportunity. Brown-Forman does the same thing. Lexmark does that. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of synergy that kind of comes together.
Yeah, I can attest that approach to sharing knowledge and creating and expanding on ideas works. When I was with the SAMS program with the Army, we had one of the instructional, well, throughout the whole program, you know, we're going to school to become operational planners for the military, and for me with other branches of government service. But we're going to be strategic planners. And wait, why are we reading a book on architecture? Why are we reading old English literature? Why are we reading social sciences, history, you know, theories, you know, quantum physics?
Right.
Why are we reading this crap? You know, yeah. And wow, yeah, it's interesting because we're all sponges for knowledge. You know, everybody's in this program, and then towards the end of the course, you see it all culminate and come together, and see how all those different, completely seemingly unrelated disciplines come together, and they expand.
We're all part of a whole. I mean, this is all, you know, we're all part of the same thing, and a lot of these distinctions are artificial, that were created, you know, by people, us, to make it easier for us to teach people things or to organize things. You know, they don't make any sense. In fact, one of the interesting events we have coming this year is we have a Massimiliano is coming. He's an Italian actor and director who's coming in from Italy this year, and he's going to do a one-act play of where he goes into character as Leonardo da Vinci.
Who was probably,
if you had one person in the history of the world that was known both as a great artist and a great scientist, it was Da Vinci. The other interesting thing about him is he goes in all of his, he's interviewed. We have Nat Irvin from U of L will interview him, but all of his answers are in Italian. So it's all in Italian, so we have subtitles. So he actually goes into the character in Italian, because Da Vinci, of course,
sure,
is Italian. So we have,
that sounds fun.
And then we also have Troy Carter, who was Lady Gaga's manager, who's going to talk about how they took the strategy they came up with to take somebody who was basically a nobody and make them a star by circumventing all the normal ways that everything had typically been done. So that's the kind of diversity you get. You know, you get this kind of wild, you know, Alan Lightman is an astrophysicist from MIT, will be there as well, and you get, but you get this, it really stretches you. And the other interesting, which were Kim Fook, and we've all seen the infamous picture of the young girl being napalmed during World War II, Vietnam War. She's going to be there telling her story, which is, you know, that iconic Pulitzer Prize winning photo. So it's very eclectic, very, very kind of fast moving.
You've been doing it since 2000, correct?
Right. We started in Lexington. We did it every other year, and then we moved it permanently to Louisville and went annual in 2006.
And it's Tuesday, September 27th through the Friday the 30th. You can buy tickets individually, or you can get a Wednesday through Friday package, because Tuesday, and you were explaining to me this a little bit, to me, there is a an independent event called Thrivals.
Yeah, it's really not independent. It's called Thrivals at IF. It's connected to us, but it is somewhat distinct. It's curated and it was developed by Dr. Nat Irvin at the University of Louisville. It's really all about focused on high school students. It's very focused on imagination, diversity, the importance of diversity and bringing people together. And it's a one-day event. This year it's really interesting because this year he's got a focus on this new movie that's starting called Hidden Figures, which is the story of several young black women during the early stages of the space program who were recruited to do computational work, because before there was a lot of computers, and they did a lot of the first orbital mechanics for, you know, the Mercury program and Apollo program. And he has the writer of the book coming, and he also has one of the stars coming, Janelle Monáe, who is also a great singer, will be there as well. And then the festival starts Wednesday through Friday. You can buy day tickets. We also sell individual tickets now. That would be the 28th and 30th. And because I was coming on today, I wanted to check. I checked with our ticketing person, and there's a special offer to your listeners. We're going to offer 10 free day passes on Wednesday and 10 free paid passes on Friday to your listeners for the first 10 people that email us at info@ideafestival.com. If you email us at idea@ideafestival.com, we have 10 day passes for Wednesday and 10 for Friday. Thursday is sold out, but we have 10 for Wednesday and Thursday that we'll give to your listeners free of charge.
Now, what should they put in the subject line? Maybe Bluegrass Bios?
Just put Bluegrass Bios tickets, and we'll get right back to them.
You hear that, ladies and gentlemen? What a deal for you.
Yeah. That's about $150 value. So it would 10 for Wednesday and 10 for Friday.
Now, if you tend to be more interested in events on one day versus another, you can go to ideafestival.com. They've got a very nice website that lays out all the presenters and the different events going on the different days. I appreciate you coming in and spending some time with us.
Yeah, let me just add one quick thing. Just down the road from you all on Short Street, 333 Short Street, is where Space Tango, which is the for-profit company that we created that now does most of our space work, has its own space design center, and it's in the original Good Sam Hospital that's been renovated. And in that center, in that complex, we actually have our own mission control operation. So we have 24-hour access, video data and audio access to the astronauts. And we welcome people to give us a call and come through. We have a lot of groups come through there if they want to see a fully operational space, basically space center, where we do our design and manufacturing of our equipment, but we also have a mission operations center, just like Johnson Space Center. So we communicate. When we have things on station, we communicate directly with the astronauts.
That's really cool.
That's cool. That's awesome.
I guess I have one more question. And maybe it's an observation that you can comment on. It seems to me from this conversation that it is incumbent upon innovators to pass that along to the younger generation. Do you feel
absolutely.
That way?
Yeah, and we have a lot of students we use at Space Tango and in exomedicine, and quite frankly, we use them for two reasons, not just to give them a good education, I mean, to help them, but we actually believe completely that we use them because we get more out of them than they get out of us. Because when you're dealing with a new frontier like exomedicine, you need people who are counterintuitive thinkers. And students and young people are counterintuitive
thinkers.
They got that in space. You know, there's a great Zen saying that says, you know, to the expert there are many, there are few opportunities, to the beginner there are many. And I think so. We use students not just to you know give them that opportunity, but we've got students, high school students now, literally who are designing experiments for station that we're going to fly, not as an educational exercise, but because we think there's real value there. So.
Thank you very much. Chris Kimmel, founder and president of Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation. For more information about what they do, you can go to kstc.com. If you want to learn more about exomedicine, their website's currently under construction, but you can follow them on Twitter @exomedicine. If you want to learn more about the CubeSats that we were talking about earlier, go to kentuckyspace.com. And if you want more information about the IDEA Festival at the Kentucky Center in Louisville, September 27th through the 30th, go to ideafestival.com. And if you lucky ducks want to get some free passes, email idea@ideafestivals with the subject line.
IDEA Festival singular.
ideafestivalsingular.com. See, accuracy is important in science, ladies and gentlemen. With the headline or the subject line, Bluegrass Bios Tickets. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to be right back with Bryant Carter. I think he'll be here in just a minute. This is Bluegrass Bios on WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio.